Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. It's our monthly book show, and the theme is handwriting, letters, diaries, and journals. Retired reference librarian Jill Erickson is here. Hi, Jill.
Good morning.
And past chair of Falmouth Reads, Jane Afredi. Hi.
Good morning.
All right. So this was your idea.
Well, yes, it started out
handwriting.
It was very specific, and my very specific desire was to read about books having to do with handwriting. And I think part of that is I have this certain fear, given that I've been around for a reasonable amount of time, that soon nobody's going to know how to read handwriting. And right. If you can't read handwriting, then how much history do you lose?
Right.
And I do know that, for example, the Schlesinger Library, they have lots and lots of journals that are very old, lots of old diaries, and they actually are now transcribing those, not just so that everybody in the world can see it, but so that people will be able to read it. Because really, the further back you go, even very old diaries or journals or letters can be really difficult to read because it doesn't ring with your brain for whatever reason. And letters are somewhat made differently, or there's a lot of cursive, and there are a lot of people don't even know what cursive writing is.
A lot of schools aren't even teaching it anymore,
let alone handwriting. So it's a really interesting topic, I think, the whole business of handwriting and who's doing it, who's not doing it, who's wants it to continue, who doesn't want it to continue. A really interesting set of groups on that.
And we sort of expanded it to include like journals and diaries and things, because those are handwritten, most of them, right?
They certainly are. And some of the work behind transcribing those into something that you can read, whether it's back into cursive that you can read or something else, is really, there's some fascinating stories out there about how people have decoded. Especially diaries, secret diaries.
Secret diaries. All right, well, let's get started. Jill, what's your first book?
Well, the first thing I want to bring up here is a little essay. There are essays by Pamela Paul, who wrote for, I think, still writing for the New York Times. And her book was called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet. And I have a lot of sympathy for this book. But one of the things that she mentions in here, there are, needless to say, many things, but the one that caught my eye was penmanship. And it begins like this. In sixth grade, I got an unsatisfactory, the dour euphemism for an F at Main Street School. In penmanship on my report card, my lowercase h did not begin, as it should have, from the bottom, but started instead with a top curly Q, an approach I'd perfected in my efforts to develop a signature style, an extravagance that didn't fly with Miss Harper. None of my kids have known the pain of as unsatisfactory in penmanship. And not because their handwriting is particularly good, but because penmanship is no longer considered worthy of grading at all. The Common Core curriculum emphasizes legible handwriting only for kindergartners and first graders before toggling over to keyboard instruction. And that, I think, is one of the real challenges in reading diaries and journals and letters from the past, is you have to be able to read handwriting in order to understand what they are. But luckily, there are lots of books that have been included diaries and journals and letters, so that there's a lot out there, but there is a lot that still needs to be found.
Right. So that book again is?
This is called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet by Pamela Paul, and it is really fascinating. There's another section in here about handwritten letters, which also apparently are no longer. But again, even with that, this is how she starts. Who would throw away a personal letter? No one, not unless she was good and angry, and in that case, the letter would be burned, at least in the movies, where it would be tossed into an open fireplace or else lit by hand and held until the recipient's fingers nearly ignited with symbolic fury. Otherwise, letters were tidily folded back into their original envelopes and, if you are an organizer, tucked into files marked correspondence, or at the very least, shoved into a shoebox or the bottom of a desk drawer. Postcards might spend some time affixed to the refrigerator first, which I think is great. And I do think, I mean, as somebody who has saved piles and piles and piles of letters, I now feel like it's a good thing I did, because these people no longer write letters.
Yeah.
Like,
wow. I did. I threw them out.
Did you really?
I did, yeah.
Was it,
I mean,
did you just, not find that painful to do?
No, or? I did not, because it's just like, oh, this, how much stuff can you keep, right? I mean, yeah.
I know.
But I did read them first again to remind myself. And it, my grandmother saved all the correspondence that any of us sent to her. And when she died, went through some, we all had a drawer, which was kind of interesting. And one of my aunts went through and read stuff that when she was in college that she sent to my grandmother. And she goes, I was so mean to her.
Oh.
We don't need to be reminded of that.
Well, and with the, you know, I also keep journals. So it's like, yeah, with all that paper, yeah, in the house, it's like, what am I going to do with this all? But it's really, it's like time travel.
Yeah,
reading,
I was going to say
journals,
I think, yeah, would, yeah, be really interesting to go back and kind of look at.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the discussion sort of raises the point of multiple audiences for, mm-hmm, all of these genres of writing. Like, people keep diaries. Do they keep them for themselves? Do they,
right,
keep them for the next generation? Do they keep them for publication?
Yeah.
And I, you know, when I'm reading published accounts of from letters or journals, I'm always wondering who really was the intended audience, mm, for all of this. Am I reading something that was really meant for somebody else?
Interesting.
Or,
yeah,
was this meant for me?
Yeah. All right, so what's your first book?
So I'm going to jump right on The Secret Diaries.
Ooh,
to start,
yay,
with, so to keep people waiting in anticipation. So I want to start with The Secret Diaries of Miss Anne Lister, which were edited by a British woman named Helena Whitbread. If you watch HBO, you might be familiar with a series that came out maybe 6 or 7 years ago called Gentleman Jack. And it was about a 19th century woman who was a landowner in England. Her name is Anne Lister. And she was what most people refer to as sort of the first modern lesbian. She kept these diaries about her life as a woman trying to be herself in a world, in a time that just did not accept that at all, even though her family was quite accepting. Most of society wasn't. So instead of what she did, she kept diaries for almost 35 years. They ended up being close to 5 million words in length over the course of those 35 years. And what she did is her diary was in two parts. She wrote the mundane stuff of life on her farm in English. And she coded the parts where she discussed her relationships with other women.
Mm.
And I've seen photos of, or, you know, PDFs of the diary pages. And it looks like a combination of sort of Greek and advanced calculus. All of these.
So it was a code she made up.
Yes.
It's like a language all her own.
She created her own code.
Wow.
And, but the decoding, the diaries are interesting. If you've watched the series, it's fairly true to what the diaries are. But the decoding of the diary is the really interesting thing. So Helena Whitbread, she's a young woman from the same town where Anne Lister was born and raised and lived. And she got married early as a young woman. She raised her family. And she went back to school at a later age. She was, I think, about 50 years old when she finally got her degree. And she was looking for a great history project to work on to put her degree to good use. And she goes to the Historical Society. She finds these diaries. Nobody has fully decoded them. It's like, this is what I'm going to do. And she spent essentially the rest of her working life, decades, decoding these and publishing these letters.
Wow.
And that has become the basis for this HBO series, Gentleman Jack. And it's really a fascinating look at not just these relationships. Some of the excerpts are pretty lurid, but to say the least. But it's really just an interesting look at how a woman decided she was just going to live like every other regular person in her orbit. It's just that she was in love with other women.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was really some of the thinking behind the way she lived is very much advanced. I mean, it's sort of very 21st century.
You can see how exciting that would be to be the decoder.
Yes.
And like as you sort of figure out some of these little pieces, I mean, it's like solving the mystery, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What fun. And again, the name of the book is
there are several volumes of this, The Secret Diaries of Miss Anne Lister.
Love it. Okay. Jill.
Well, I have to start with this quote from Fanny Fern, which is, I brought along, if you can believe this, this is my senior thesis from college. And this, in fact, was the title of this was, When the Hand That Penned It Shall Be Dust, Women in Their Diaries in 19th Century America.
And
and look at this old typewriter.
And that's how old this is.
This is a thesis that's at least an inch thick.
Yeah. More than.
What I have here is a quote from Fanny Fern. And this is a great quote in how I opened this whole piece of work that I did. She wrote, "Look around and see innumerable women to whose barren and loveless lives this would be improvement and solace. And I say to them, write. Right. It will be a safe outlet for thoughts and feelings that maybe the nearest friend you have has never dreamed had place in your heart and brain. It is not safe for the women of 1867 to shut down so much that cries out for sympathy and expression, because life is such a maelstrom of business or folly or both that those to whom they have bound themselves body and soul recognize only the needs of the former. One of these days, when that diary is found, when the hand that penned it shall be dust, with what amazement and remorse will many a husband or father exclaim, I never knew my wife or my child till this moment."
Mm. Oh.
Which I think is just a wonderful way to describe journals and diaries. And that was written by Fanny Fern. There's also a quote here by Ralph Ellison, who wrote, "Much of what gets into American literature gets there because so much is left out." So this whole process of working on women's diaries was very interesting. But I also have a real interest in handwriting and how people were doing handwriting. And so I brought along this book called The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting by Anne Trubeck. And she begins, well, this is one section of the book where she's talking about, most of us take it as a truism that writing is good, ennobling, and central to being an educated citizen. Socrates, ancient Greece's greatest thinker, believed the opposite. He argued vehemently through speeches Plato later wrote down that writing caused humans to become less intelligent, less civilized, and less creative. As he put it, a reader must be singularly simple-minded to believe that written words can do anything more than remind one of what one already knows. So that was one opinion of what would happen. But the review of this was really quite good. And it's very, I mean, it's not a long book, but it's very interesting. In Publishers Weekly, they wrote, "What does the future hold for the oldest analog communication technology? Writing by hand? Do we really need it?" Trubeck, publisher of Belt magazine, explores these questions in a thoroughly enjoyable slim volume that begins with scratches on clay tablets and ends with National Handwriting Day, which I have to say I did not even know existed until this book, which is celebrated every January 23rd. So I have to January 23rd is the birthday. This is the rather funny part of it: the birthday of John Hancock, the man who signed his name so dramatically on the Declaration of Independence. Ancient Sumerian writing was limited to records and ceremony. Literacy became essential to a cultured person in ancient Greece with the invention of the modern alphabet, but not everyone welcomed it. Which also, and I feel like I've got a lot of displeasure that everybody's using computers all the time rather than writing letters. But you see, even so, you know, there's something, always something people don't like about whether you're writing or not writing or how you're writing. But he ends this with saying, Trubeck ends her delightful history with the conclusion that handwriting will not vanish, but perhaps, like letterpress printing, become a fine art.
Oh, interesting.
So, which I've, like, I suppose that could happen. Yeah. And there have been exhibits now of handwriting.
But think of how many book covers today are illustrated with exquisite handwriting on the covers rather than type or art.
And this one I'm holding in my hand has handwriting on the front of it. And the book is The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting by Anne Trubeck.
Yeah. I should remind listeners, we will have a list with a link to all the books we talk about later today at our website, capeandislands.org. It is the monthly book show. If you'd like to suggest a book with our theme this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. The theme is handwriting. We're talking letters, diaries, and journals with reference librarian Jill Erickson and past chair of Falmouth Reads, Jane Ifrady. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
Jane,
I'm sorry. Jill just did it before the break. Yeah, sorry.
You were looking in the right direction, though.
You were. So sort of back to the theme of the audience for letters or journals or anything. I love this collection of letters by Flannery O'Connor called The Habit of Being. And Flannery O'Connor was one of the great Southern writers. And she kept everything. She kept every letter she wrote to people, and she kept the ones that were coming into her. And this has become a very rich collection of who she was, what she thought about society and religion and her private life, the creative process, so many aspects of what she did so well as a writer. But the collection contains letters that went to a certain person or were written to a certain, written from a certain person or to a certain person. And then they've ended up in this collection suddenly. And I don't think that people are identified as the writers of these letters when it's sort of like fan mail. But some of these have ended up as examples of why she is sometimes exasperated by literary criticism. And they're hilarious. I mean, there's certainly really quick wit in a lot of Flannery O'Connor's writing. There's also a lot of darkness. Mm-hmm. But these letters are a joy to read. So I just wanted one short excerpt from one of the letters that she wrote to a friend. Week before last, I went to Wesleyan and read A Good Man is Hard to Find, one of her most famous short stories. After, I went to one of the classes where I was asked questions. There were a couple of young teachers there, and one of them, an earnest type, started asking the questions. Miss O'Connor, he said, why is the misfit's hat black? I said most countrymen in Georgia wore black hats. He looked pretty disappointed. Then he said, Miss O'Connor, the misfit represents Christ, does he not? He does not, I said. He looked crushed. Well, Miss O'Connor, he said, what is the significance of the misfit's hat? I said it was to cover his head. And after that, he left me alone. Anyway, that's what's happening in the teaching of literature.
Oh, that's funny.
A lot of the letters are these witticisms, these sort of crazy looks at contemporary culture from her time that are, again, just a joy to read.
Yeah. And the book, again, is?
It is The Habit of Being by Flannery O'Connor. It's a collection of her letters.
Jill.
All right. So this is what got me writing letters again. Not this actual book, but the person who wrote this book during the pandemic. Rachel Syme, who writes for The New Yorker, has just come out with a book called Syme's Letter Writer. And what she had done during the pandemic was she got unbelievable number of people to write, become pen pals. She decided people needed something to do that year that nobody was going anywhere, and that she would try to get everybody to write to other people.
What a good idea.
And it was a fabulous idea. I still have a pen pal that I got from the time that she was putting this all together. And there's this big article that about this book in Vanity Fair recently, and they wrote, Syme has an ongoing pen pal exchange service called Penpalooza, and I'd forgotten that. That really is what it was called, Penpalooza, which she began in 2020, and she periodically puts out a call for signups via social media. Here she chats about favorite letter collections, fountain pen forums, and the impulse to connect offline. And they ask her, do you have a daily letter writing practice? And she says, I usually, instead of morning pages like some people, I wake up and I'll write a letter. I'll wake my brain up by writing someone a letter, but usually it's really dedicated on the weekends. So it's maybe Sunday night. I'll have a glass of whiskey and sit down and answer my mail. I feel like Princess Diana, like, okay, here we go. So the interview actually itself is very funny. And she decided that she would try to get everybody writing letters during that time. And she had to work with some, there was like some thing that was really for Christmas card delivery, it's some computer program, but she used it in order to give us all addresses to various people. And she had this book that she has now come out with called Syme's Letter Writer, A Guide to Modern Correspondence, is really, for one thing, just a beautiful book. It is heavily illustrated and quite lovely just to look at. She also, at the end of the book, has empty pages that you can tear out and send a letter from there. But she has instructions on, for example, how to be a pen pal in case, you know, you don't know or you haven't been a pen pal. I think the first pen pal I had was when I was in sixth grade and we were writing letters. It might have been fifth grade. We were writing letters. Our teacher somehow got us hooked up with soldiers in Vietnam, and we were writing letter, and I remember being heartbroken when, and this fellow was writing back to me. I mean, it was just amazing when I think about it now, but then he stopped writing, and of course I always was afraid that was a bad sign that he stopped writing, although I have not found him, so I don't know, maybe he's still with us. But there are instructions on here, for example, how to be a pen pal, and then she also lists famous pen pals, in case you're wondering who might, and I'm sure most of these have been printed. So, for example, Truman Capote and Patricia Highsmith, Ralph Ellison and Shirley Jackson, which is sort of an interesting combo, Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. She has all of that. She also has how to press a flower, if you want to put that into your letter. She has every artist needs her tools, letter writer essentials. I mean, it's sort of funny and silly, but it's also, you know, she's giving some good information out. And then seriously consider writing about the last time you stayed out after 2 a.m. So she gives you all kinds of ideas, how to write about clothing, she has ink samples here. So it's a very fun book, but also very practical in its own way. And it is called Syme's Letter Writer by Rachel Syme, A Guide to Modern Correspondence.
Yeah, you just reminded me, my grandson, who's 9, fourth grade, he just wrote a letter. He's just written his second one. He watches this YouTube kid called Evan Storm. And basically, like, he plays along. The kid plays with all these, you know, toys. And I'm sure this kid now is probably in his 20s, but he thinks he's 10 years old. So there's an address. So he wrote him a letter. This was maybe a month ago, and no response. So he said, I'm writing a second letter. I don't think the first one got there. And I'm really keeping my fingers crossed that somebody answers this kid's fan mail. But it's handwritten. It's a handwritten letter. I hadn't thought about it enough, but it's a good thing.
Happy to hear this.
Yeah, me too. And we'll keep our fingers crossed that Evan Storm answers him.
Excellent.
Jane, what's next?
So my next one is a novel. It's called Ella Minopi by Mark Dunn. It was published in 2001. And it's described as, I have to read this very carefully because I'll mispronounce all of this, a progressively lipogrammatic epistolary fable.
Woof. Mouthful.
A mouthful. It's a great read. And it's a very quick read. It's a novel set on a fictitious island of Nollop, N-O-L-L-O-P, off the coast of South Carolina. And it's the home to the fictional Kevin Nollop, who is the fictional creator of the well-known pangram, The Quick Brown Fox Jumps Over the Lazy Dog. he is so revered for this phrase that there is on the official Capitol steps, there is a monument to him and this phrase. But they're living in coastal South Carolina, and the ocean and the salt air and everything else, you know, wreaks its havoc. And one by one, the letters start to fall off the monument. Mm-mm. What that means for the governing group on Nollop Island is that as a letter falls off, it is now stricken from usage.
Oh.
So the Z falls off and you can no longer use the Z in any correspondence. And so the novel is a series of letters from our 18-year-old protagonist who's trying to find a way to preserve all of the letters that Nollop or somebody else gave to us and to continue to use them in prop. And you know, you can't say words with these
can't
write words with these letters. And one by one, they drop off. And so the writing of the letters in this novel drops. They start dropping these letters.
Oh, wow.
And people, the author is very creative in helping his characters write around these things. And then at the at the end, there's a sort of a race to say, because we're almost out of letters. And this 18-year-old is able to find a way to prove that this is all folly, that we should restore all of the letters back to their proper usage. And I won't say how she does that, but she does that. It's very inventive. And it's just a great example of not only just using letters to tell a story, but how our brains can so easily adapt to reading words that are, they're a jumbled mess of creative spellings of words that we know, and we can still identify them as words that we know.
Interesting. That sounds like it would be tough to write, huh?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And the name again is?
It is Ella Minnow P, a play on Ella Minnow P, by Mark Dunn.
Okay.
Which I'm so glad you brought that book, because I love that book. When I first read that, I thought it was just so great.
Very
so
creative. Yeah.
So creative.
Yeah.
All right. What have you got next, Jill?
Okay. So the next one I have is called, is a novel, more or less. And it's called Empty Words by Mario Lavriero. I'm not sure of the pronunciation there. It's published by Coffee House Press, which is a small press in Minneapolis. And I just shout out thanks to the Catuit Library for having purchased this book, because it is really fascinating.
It's a small book, too.
It's a small book, but boy, does it pack a punch. And this is part one exercises, September 10th, 1990. My graphological self-therapy begins today. This method, suggested a while ago by a crazy friend, stems from the notion, which is central to graphology, that there's a profound connection between a person's handwriting and his or her character. Hmm. And from the behaviorist tenet that changes in behavior can lead to changes on a psychological level. The idea then is that by changing the behavior observed in a person's handwriting, it may be possible to change other things about that person. My aims at this stage of the therapeutic endeavor are fairly modest. At first, I'm going to practice writing by hand. I won't be attempting calligraphy, but I'll at least try to manage a script that anyone could read, myself included, because these days my writing's often so bad that not even I can decipher it.
That's the
beginning of this. And Publishers Weekly describes it as a grumpy writer seeks to focus his mind with handwriting exercises prizes in this charming novel, the first Uruguayan author Lavrero to be translated into English. Frustrated by his mindless scattered days of attempting to write amid the constant distractions of family life, Lavrero's narrator embraces graphological self-therapy, hoping that improving the legibility of his handwriting will translate into an improvement in my concentration and the continuity of my thoughts. It's a very fun story, although some very sad things as well, but and at the end, the narrator's histrionics over his mundane responsibilities may be laughable, but his anxieties and preoccupations are captured with such precision by Lavrero that the reader will breathe a sigh of relief whenever the exercises resume after a stress-induced break. Mm-hmm. Quote, going back to these exercises is always a first step towards psychological health, the narrator writes, and it's hard not to be persuaded that clearly printing one's S's and G's may just be the secret to a happy life after all. So this is Empty World, Mario Lavrero. It's a short novel, but it's really interesting, and I highly recommend it.
All right. Jane.
All right. I would love to continue on with the epistolary novels. One of my favorites, all-time favorites, is Dangerous Liaisons, the original text. Amazing piece. And we sort of forget that a lot of our sort of most famous classical novels, Frankenstein, Dracula, it's so many, you know, even Pride and Prejudice, it's believed that that started out as an epistolary novel. But this one, groundbreaking. So the short story is there is a marquise and a viscount, and they were lovers, they've turned rivals, and now they're just out to ruin everybody and each other. And the story is told through this series of letters back and forth to each other about their exploits. It was seen at the time as sort of, even though it was published well before the French Revolution, it was seen as a statement on the French leadership at the time, the king. What is interesting about this is, I mean, the book is fascinating. It's a fantastic read. The warning from the publisher at the start, there are two separate warnings before the original text of this. One is from the editor, one is from the publisher. Mm-hmm. And this is at the time of the publisher. I have to read the publisher. It's pretty funny. We believe we should warn the public that, despite the title of this work and what the editor says in his preface, we do not guarantee the authenticity of this collection, and we even have strong reasons to believe that it is only a novel. So it was so realistic that they were afraid people would think that these were real letters between real members of the court. Several of the characters he depicts have had such bad morals that it is impossible to suppose that they lived in our country. In this century of philosophy, where enlightenment spread everywhere has made everyone, all men, so honest, and all women, so modest and so reserved. This, of course, the text of this is the exact opposite of this, and likely that time in France is the exact opposite of what the publisher believes is true of society at that time. But it's a fantastic read. It's Dangerous Liaisons by Delaclos.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to suggest a book for our list today, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. The theme is handwriting. We're talking about letters, diaries, and journals with retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and past chair of Falmouth Reads, Jane Ifredi. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
Well, I have a couple things to mention that are not books exactly. Well, but partly a quote from a book, but also just to let you know what you can do if you put your mind to it. I had a friend who moved to Sarasota from Falmouth, and I wanted to hear more from her, so I thought, well, I'm going to start writing her postcards. So I started this whole series of postcards that became the 10 steps of how to write a letter. And so the first one was, Dear Andrea, welcome to the Refrigerator Cards 10-Step Program to Write a Letter. We are glad you are here. Step one, turn off your computer. Sincerely yours, Letter Guide, Chester B. Ficklejam said. And I had forgotten these completely, and she reminded me of them. And it's this whole sort of crazy series. She gets more advanced.
Did she not know how to write a letter?
Well, a lot of people want to write email these days. I don't know.
Got it.
She definitely knows how to write. She does. And I also was sent this quote from Swan's Way, Marcel Proust, in which he says, an hour or so later, he received a note from Odette and at once recognized that florid handwriting in which an affectation of British stiffness imposed an apparent discipline upon its shapeless characters, significant perhaps to less intimate eyes than his, of an untidiness of mind, a fragmentary education, a want of sincerity and decision. So florid handwriting is, you know, if it's good enough for Proust, it's good enough for you to think about how you can how you can write better or try writing better. But the next book I have is Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting by Kitty Burns Flory. And the chapters include Pen, Paper, Ink, A Stroll Through Handwriting History, the Golden Age of Penmanship, Graphology, the analysis of handwriting with the purpose of revealing personality and character, writing by hand in a digital age, and is handwriting important? That's the last chapter. And there was this great review of this book in the New York Magazine by Sam Anderson. And he writes, reading a handwritten article about handwriting in a 21st century magazine is like listening to your great-great-grandfather shout in the middle of a crowded multiplex about the incomparable glories of vaudeville and the lost art of wearing hats in public. And yet somehow, here we are. Certain vestigial urges have been awakened deep in the muscles of my fingers and wrists by Script and Scribble, Kitty Burns Flory's paean to the now nearly defunct barbarism of dragging ink trails across paper. I've switched to print for the reasons we always end up switching to print. My handwriting, set against a neat field of type, looks like a giant mess of alien runes, and my keyboard-weakened fingers tend to cramp up after a couple of sentences. Flory, a non-educated scriptomaniac, lovingly traces the history of handwriting from its ancient birth to its imminent demise. Mm. She rounds up some fascinating arcana that a typical pencil, and I have to say I did not know this, a typical pencil can draw a line 35 miles long that Confederate soldiers boiled rusty nails in vinegar during an ink shortage, that the Coca-Cola logo, now an icon of scriptographic fanciness, was once probably just a typical bookkeeper's hand. So the book's margins are credited with illustrative photos. Flory's own earnest third grade penmanship exercises, the clotted page of a Dickens manuscript. So it's a really interesting and lovely book. It's called Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting by Kitty Burns Flory. And there are people who hope that people continue to write with pens or pencils.
I'm just going to say, I'm looking. You have a pen in your hand.
I do.
And Jane and I both have pencils. And you know, it's funny. I was thinking this. I always go for the pencil. And why, you ask? Back in my reporting days, when I was a reporter in Maine, it's very cold outside. And your pen would freeze. My pencil never froze. And you can write at any angle, right? So pencils.
Well, and may I say, this is a fountain pen that I've got, not just a big
just
pen.
Very, very impressive, Jill.
Exactly.
I love fountain pens.
Yeah, so. Yeah, you'll have to pry the pencil out of my cold,
right, I know,
dead
right?
hands.
Pencil, right. All right. Carol in Falmouth has two suggestions. She said, just out, From Ted to Tom, reproductions of envelopes sent by Edward Gorey. And another one that she says possibly could be out of print, The Jolly Postman by Janet and Alan Alberg. Well, you have that.
And I have the From Ted to Tom right in my hand here. Oh. Thank you, Carol. Good suggestion.
Do you want to talk about that before we go back to...
Well, just to say that it's a really, it is in fact Edward's correspondence with this fellow who was a big fan of his. And the greatest thing about Edward's letters are his decoration of the envelopes, because he does incredible artwork.
I would have saved those.
It's really a beautiful book, and this illustrate these illustrated envelopes he saved, not surprisingly, that Edward Gorey said. But apparently they wrote to each other for a year, and then Edward just stopped writing, and that was it. So I'm like, I don't know what happened. But,
moving on.
But the illustrations are great, and of course, Edward has a great had a great sense of humor as well.
All right, Jane, what's next?
Well, this conversation about sort of what we lose when we lose handwriting sort of leads into perfectly the next book that I want to talk about, which is Why Fonts Matter. By Sarah Hindman. It's a classic. It was published in 2016. It's one of the books that most graphic designers have on their shelves. Let me preface this a little bit. Last month, we were in New York City. We went to go see Gypsy with Audra McDonald, which, just an aside, fantastic. Go see her if you can. But behind us were two young men, and they were chit-chatting as they were leafing through their playbill. And they were making comments about all the ads that they saw in the playbill about how the type was wrong here or it didn't look right there. And one of them just says, "Well, you know, fonts matter." And I turned with the curtain, then the curtain went down, and at the intermission, I turned around and said, "Thank you so much. That's been my mantra for most of my life. Fonts matter." And I think that comes from having a last name that begins with IA, like many Italian based surnames. IA is common, but here it's not. And more often than not, my official name is LA and the rest of it. And to make a correction, and I have to always say, begins with an I, like Italian. Fonts matter. Yeah. What Sarah Hindman does in this book is she goes into great detail about the things that we take for granted. We see things like the Coca-Cola logo, and we don't understand sort of the meaning behind the way it's designed. And you think about like the FedEx logo. That's fonts matter there. There are so many things that we see all the time that impact how we can read, how we can understand, and how we understand sort of the subtext of the communications that we receive. And a lot of that has to do with the font choices, the size, the bold or light or italic or whatever. It really changes the way that we read things. And I think it's a great sort of counterpoint to the idea that, and I'm not saying anybody here shares this but we do lose something when we lose handwriting, but we also gain something when we move into sort of the next generation of writing that can be specifically designed to create a mood almost anything, the message.
A memory. Yeah.
A memory. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So this is Why Fonts Matter by Sarah Hindman.
Right. Jill.
Okay. I've brought The Magic of Handwriting, the Pedro Correa do Lago Collection, the Morgan Library and Museum. And I am so sorry I did not get to see this exhibit. However, this book is all about the magic of handwriting. As somebody wrote about this, we are living in a golden age of both fretting about handwriting and fetishizing it. Polemicists lament that cursive is going the way of the dodo. Meanwhile, old school devotees of pen and paper post their work on social media with hashtags like snail mail and pen pal. The Magic of Handwriting, an exhibition at the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, might seem at first glance to be part of this nostalgia. Instead, it simply luxuriates in the humble, intimate, and sometimes very messy traces that some of the great figures of history have left behind. The show and the book features some 140 items from the encyclopedic holdings of the Brazilian collector Pedro Correa do Lago, who got his start at the age of 11 when he wrote to prominent figures to ask for their autographs, which used to be a really popular thing to do.
Yeah.
Today, he owns roughly 100,000 letters, notes, receipts, manuscripts, signed photographs, and other pieces documenting notable lives in the arts, politics, science, and other fields. And this book has the images. You can see everything that they've put in, which they had on the walls or in the cases at the Morgan. And so you can see both the handwriting, but they do also translate it for you so you can know what it is about. There are so many different handwritings in this alone. I mean, it's just great. Well, for those of us who love handwriting, it is really fascinating just to see how differently everybody can do handwriting.
Yeah. And some people, their handwriting is looks like artwork, right? I mean, it's so beautiful. That is not me.
That is
I'm back with the sometimes I can't read my own writing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the way we construct letters through handwriting has changed so much over even over 100 years. There are enormous differences in the way letters
absolutely,
are written.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That is correct. And that's why people need to translate these things now, get them into typewriting, what it looks like on a computer so that people can actually read what was written in the past.
Right. So that book again is?
This book is The Magic of Handwriting, the Pedro Carrillo de Lago Collection, the Morgan Library and Museum.
All right. Jane.
Okay. I'd like to go back to fiction again. One of my favorite recent reads is A Tale for Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. Ruth Ozeki is a Canadian author who lives in the Vancouver area. And A Tale for Time Being is told through a series of journal entries by a 13-year-old Japanese-American girl who's gone through some troubled times. She's bullied. Her father is laid off from his job. She's written this diary as sort of, in a way, a last will and testament to honor her grandmother, who was this sort of not imaginary, sort of legendary figure in martial art in Japan, martial arts, and she just did all these things that were very unusual for a woman of her age and time. So she puts this all in her journal, puts it in a Hello Kitty lunchbox, and it ends up in the ocean, and it has washed ashore in Vancouver. So the author is it reads like almost a autobiography of the author, because it is so close to her tale. But this is just sort of a very interesting look at, you know, again, sort of author or, you know, audience and author and what it means to write a diary, to read a diary, and how that becomes something bigger than maybe what it was meant to be. It's a fantastic read. And it also plays with time because you don't know the young girl's name is Now, N-A-O. And you don't know if she's writing this 20 years ago or yesterday or...
So it's kind of timeless.
It's very timeless. It plays with time, thus A Tale for the Time Being is the name of the book. But it's all through these diary entries of this young girl and they're being read by a much older woman who's trying to figure out who this is. Does she need help? What can I do? How can I elevate this story? It's a very quick read and a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I should remind, we will have a link up on our website a little bit later today about all the books we talked about here this morning at capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, retired reference librarian, and Jane Ifredi, past chair of Falmouth Reads. As always, thank you, ladies, for sharing your picks with us. Always gives us something to think about. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you,
Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.